This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 31st of December, 1961. The title of this lecture is The Goals Problem Mass. This tape is 55 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Well, I see you decided to develop some ARC overnight, so that is good. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. You know, it isn't quite as bad as you think, you know. It really isn't quite as bad as you think. It's much worse. The second day of this Congress, and I've got a lot of ground to cover this Congress, but we fortunately have a three-day Congress and lots of time to cover it in. So I can sort of take it easy at two or three light years per minute. Well, I'd like to talk to you today something about this and that and the other thing. None of it very important. Merely affects your future. And the future of the country and that sort of thing. I don't think anything could affect the future of the country just at the present moment, however. I'm pretty sure that's the case. Nothing could affect the future of the country. It's at no effect. What I've seen since I've been back is quite interesting. I haven't been out of the hotel, but a lot of people go down to the Congo for 24 hours and there's authorities thereafter, and a lot of people go to Australia and are authorities thereafter, and seems to be that they're an authority in direct ratio to the small amount of time spent in the area. So I'm an authority on the present American situation because I haven't been out of the hotel since my arrival. But it's nevertheless good to be back. I've had a lot of complaints. We get a lot of complaints at St. Hill, tremendous number of complaints from American students there. They're put over the jumps, you see, very heavily, very hard. And it's pretty grim, actually. Their day begins at about 3 a.m. and ends at 10 p.m. Oh, it's not quite that bad, actually, 3:30. And the American students all find it is too cold. And the English student uniformly finds the rooms much too hot. You see, they're used to a cool climate there. And the other students from the Commonwealth, well, they don't quite know what to think. But the truth of the matter is that you just can't cater to anybody, so everybody, you see, so we just don't cater to anybody. And we've got the English climate turned on very well. English climate's turned on pretty well up. And it has a nasty reputation, very nasty reputation the English climate does. Totally undeserved. Much better climate than Washington, D.C. Infinitely better. And an auditor flew in last night from Florida, couldn't come to the Congress, flew in, saw me, went down, climbed on a plane, went back to Florida, and they were getting on their fur coats as they left, not as they arrived. It's apparently warmer here than in Florida just now. This climate situation is very confusing. The reason why I operate in England might possibly interest you. What's he doing over in England? What's he doing over in England? Well, England is in communication with the rest of the world. That's right. That's true. It's not even a crack. You go down here to an accountant, and you say to Price Waterhouse, American accounting firm, you say, well, now, we've got some money owing to us in Cape Town. Would you please collect it? And the fellow says, what state's that in? You think I'm kidding. Try to execute some particular administrative activity on communication lines. It's all from nowhere. And you wouldn't realize this unless you're in my boots. Because we have to have fast, fantastically rapid communications throughout Scientology. They're not always in a screaming fury, but when they go into a screaming fury, they have to be fast. We're always there many, many hours, years, and days before anybody else thinks we even got started. We make up with speed what we lack in numbers. We make up in ability what we lack in guns. Our wars fought very successfully along very fast communication lines. Very, very little can be done to Scientology. We can't head off long before it happens. So that fast communications are a substitute for enormous resources. You should look at the Telex network, which now exists throughout Scientology. It's very interesting. There isn't a major office that isn't, or there isn't an office that isn't on the Telex. You can go into any Scientology office and be in direct communication on teletypewriters with any other Scientology office throughout the world. You didn't know we'd moved up that high. Well, it's there. And England happens to make a better central for that particular type of activity. You can get to all parts of Scientology from England faster than from the United States. That always comes as a shock when you bring it up to America. But remember, America's a brand new civilization. It's a brand new country. It's only been here about 100 and 200, something like that, years. And it hasn't had time to groove in ruts. That's what it amounts to. And one of the difficulties it's having on the international scene right now, it doesn't have any well-worn ruts. You can't drop anything accidentally and have it roll to the right position without any effort. It's very amusing that old civilizations leave their communication networks in place. And the oldest communication network in existence now, which is still functioning, comes out of Greece. It's the oldest civilized communication network. It's very fascinating to watch that communication network in action. The Greek is totally convinced that he is still the center of the world. And it's so long ago that he was that you, at this moment, don't even think that he ever really was the center of the world. Isn't that right? You thought of Rome, the might of Rome rolling out across the frontiers and smashing down the barbarians, but never Greece. And remember, it was Greece that exported all the civilization that Rome profited by. And the Greek sits down there in Athens, totally convinced that he's the center of the world and his communication lines still reach everywhere. And we look for this in actuality, and it gives us a rather amusing slant on things. He is. The lines are still there. Did you ever hear of Greek shipping interests? You have heard of it then. Those communication lines still do exist. And over that pattern lies the Roman communication system. And you go down to Rome, and you find out that Air Paris has bigger offices in Rome than in Paris. Isn't that fascinating? At least it looks so, standing out in the street. But the Italian has never found out that the Roman Empire folded. He just never found it out. And he has communication lines and means of getting to the rest of the world that would absolutely clobber you if you inspected them. It's fantastic. It didn't even go down in World War II. And the Italian is absolutely convinced completely that he's the center of the world. Because he has been for so long. I'm sure they still have offices there that are sending dispatches out and is really set up to totally handle the sub-provisional government of England. I'm sure there's an office still there that is doing that. It really hasn't noticed that England is gone, as far as the empire is concerned, and that the communication network has moved to England. Now that is the oldest, still, long-functioning communication lines in the world. The British Empire, the sun never sets on it, although it's now a commonwealth. Although they're trying to give it away madly. Their businessmen and various other activities are all tied in neatly. It would interest you very much how easy it is to administer things from England, because even the United States has better lines from England to the United States than from the United States to England. Fascinating. Did you realize you were in a colony? Most English will make a joke out of it occasionally. They look, I say, well, I'm going over to America, and an Englishman will say to me, oh, you're going over to the colonies, you know, as a joke. And the other day the remark was made to me, just like that, oh, you're going over to the other colony. I said, look, the fellow quickly, he wasn't joking. And someday you may make the revolution good. But you haven't yet. Well, now, why? Why these intermeshes? Why this tremendous amount of hang-up, the tremendous longevity and endurance of old communication lines? What are these all about? I'd like to talk to you about problems. Wouldn't seem to have too much to do with communication lines of old civilizations. But a problem is timeless. And when you have long empire communication lines which have run into a heavy collision here and there, you, of course, have run communication lines into problems. And those problems hang up and become suspended in time and move forward on the track as though they were independent. The problems are never resolved. The loss of Spain to Greece. Oh, you didn't even know that Greece ever owned Spain. But it did, you know. They still bring in singers from their colony in Greece. In Greece, they still bring in singers from their colony in Spain. They still have guitars and that sort of thing. Well, they had an awful lot of problems connected with Spain. They were the earliest civilizing influence in there. It was just at the other end of the Mediterranean. These problems stacked up, and of course, in the cultural mind, these things have never unlocked because the problems were never resolved. Nothing ever as is these problems. And there's Greece at one end of the Mediterranean, totally stuck with Spain on the other end of the Mediterranean because it had so many problems. So the communication line floats forward because you must stay in communication with that area because you have lots of problems in that area. Although the civilization and the connection and the government and everything else is now dead and long gone, and most of the races that were there then have been moved around and upset in various ways, you still have these hard and fast communication lines. Why? Because a problem has existed. And wherever you have an unresolved problem, you continue to have communication lines. I can see it 1,000 years from now. No, maybe not 1,000, but 500 years from now. Somebody up in London suddenly finds out about America. Why, as ising some old problem concerning America. There's some part of the British Empire still trying to solve restraining colonists from selling guns and whiskey to the Indians. See, it's a problem, and they had to take responsibility for the problem. And therefore, they kept a very solid communication line in here. Very heavy communication line. Well, it just drifts forward as a sort of a shadow or ghost line because the problem was never resolved. So anyway, the difficulties of communication are only those difficulties of resolution of problems. Only those difficulties. In other words, the communication line would as is all the problems if it were good enough. That everybody is rather convinced of. The difficulties then are that the communication line did not resolve the problem, and this becomes then part of the problem, and the communication line stays in. Because the communication line did not do what it was supposed to do, which is to say resolve the problem. So it's still stuck. So you've got the problem, and now you've got the communication line. And of course, the communication line was the solution to the problem. So you still get this stuck communication line, which is floating. Because the problem is floating. Well, now, how does a problem float, and why? Let's take a look at problems. It's extremely interesting to look at a problem. Because the last time you were in difficulty, it was because there wasn't an agreement. After there had been an agreement. The first stage of a problem is an agreement. It's just an agreement. But part of this breaks down into some kind of a disagreement. Now we're talking about problems in terms of mass. Joe and Mary are married. And they're doing perfectly fine. And until they start accumulating head-on disagreements, they go on doing fine. But part of the reason that they go on is because they have problems and disagreements. In other words, some of the disagreement is used to improve the longevity of the relationship. So there's always a little bit of a feeling on the part of a thetan that he ought to have just a few small problems. Nothing very catastrophic, please, but, you'll see some family joking about it. He'll say, well, he likes Brussels sprouts and she doesn't. I sit down at the table, you'll all hear a remark on something like this. Well, Joe, he likes Brussels sprouts. I personally don't see how he stands them. You see. Well, that's just trying to get a little longevity. That's trying to buy a little time. So there's little clashes one way or the other. This is very noteworthy between two men. You see two men who have known each other for a long time. They meet after a while, and you would think they were fighting. Did you ever notice this? They're trying to get a continuum or a longevity. Not to be particularly profane about it, but one says to the other one, well, you old son of a bitch, how are you? You know? That's fight talk, you know? And the other one says, well, I'll be on top long after you're under the ground. How are you? See, something like that. Do you ever hear this kind of a conversation? It's rather astonishing. These fellows are friends. What would they be calling them to each other if they were enemies? So they get a longevity of their friendship, and they cement their communication lines by making little zzzz on them here and there, you see. So they turn this smooth line, which would simply as is, into just a little bit of a collision here and there, you see. And then you have this thing very nicely going along and so forth. They can always count on a nice row. They make sure that they play golf together, you see, and that gives them a little contest. And it's a very acceptable contest, and it makes the thing float on the time track. And if you ever want to see hatred arise, it is after that relationship has disintegrated. There is nothing quite as furious as the warfare between a couple who have loved each other dearly for a long time. When they fall apart, it's with exclamation points. There is but violence. I've often been interested in the degree of violence which can arise between a married couple. And I knew a fellow once that was foolish enough to intervene. He adjudicated from the violence of the argument that they really did hate each other. And he was wrong, you see. They had just become sufficiently anxious about longevity and survival that they were banging it in good and hard. And the basis of their argument was actually love. If you have ever done any patch-ups of this sort of thing where it has all gone to pieces and taken the wife and the husband and taken them and gotten them to get off some of their overts one way or the other, you would be fascinated at the lack of actual viciousness contained in those overts. The actual viciousness. They were upset because they couldn't help the other one. They were upset because they thought they hadn't done the other one right. They were upset because their plans to further the longevity had gone astray. And you get down to what they were really upset about. They started piling up overts right after they decided it didn't matter because it couldn't go on, you see. But it was basically something that they were trying to help each other with. And you can trace nearly all those marital arguments back to that kind of thing. They now hate each other because they loved each other too well and failed to express it adequately to each other. Now, this sort of thing is, of course, a problem. Now, a problem, by definition, is a postulate counter-postulate. And at the moment when this condition of agreement, kept together with a little bit of nattering communication with one another, you know, yappity-yap, and so forth, when you really do get a head-on collision, it will become this postulate counter-postulate, see? So we get a big one and a big one. And it'll be something more fundamental. I refuse to live in Riverton anymore. See? You will live in Riverton because my family is here. See? This is a decision to do, and this is a decision not to do, or a decision to do something else and a decision to do something else, you see. And it comes down to a head-on collision. We got postulate, counter-postulate. This is the way it's going to be. This is not the way it's going to be. Crash! And if those are of equal magnitude, we move in here. And that thing will hang in time and space because nothing disturbs its balance. They now have a problem. And that problem now moves on the time track. That is a real problem. Neither one of them thinks up the wonderful argument that will resolve the problem, such as my family is in Burbank. See? Well, the other one would think, well, there should be some give and take on this sort of thing, actually, and let's get a summer home in Burbank and work here for the winter or something like that, and you'd have some reasonability about it. But neither one of them cares to give up. A Pershing tank has run head-on into a Pershing tank. Clank. And no matter how much forward tread motion you put on these two tanks, they don't move at all. And you get the illusion of time not going forward at all, because this location, of course, is unaltered. No matter how much force is put into it, there is no alteration of location, there is no alteration of opinion, and there's no alteration of the circumstances or conditions. And what do we have? We have a result that it looks like it's forever, because there is no hope of change. And there being no hope of change, there, of course, is no change, and time equals change. And if there is no change, you have no time. And if there is change, you have time. So a postulate counter-postulate adds up to no change, no hope of change. Well, Joe, he's just never going to change his mind about that. That's it. That's it. Bang, crash, thud, you know. And Bessie, she's never going to change her mind about that. That's all. They're just convinced. And to some degree, they make sure the other one doesn't change his mind because they tell each other often that they don't. And where you get a no change arising out of the situation, you get a no time. And that is why the difficulty which you had 200 trillion years ago with another Thetan can still be found in your bank. You see why? There was no change, so no time, and it wouldn't matter how much time had gone by, you still have this interlocked problem, and you will find the problem. So therefore, the basis of the reactive mind is a problem. That is the basic fundamental of the reactive mind, a problem. There is nothing that will support anything in the reactive mind except a problem. The Thetan isn't sitting there saying, well, let's see, let's make sure I keep this mocked up, keep this mocked up, keep this mocked up, keep this mocked up. He hasn't been thinking that for 200 trillion years. I assure you, his mind has been on other things. Girls and asparagus and all sorts of things. Well, why is it, then, if he hasn't kept his mind on it, that it can still be found there? Well, let's assault those people in the audience that I'm glad to see that their friends brought here, because Ron always gives a simpler lecture than a P.E. I apologize to you for exceeding your reality on the subject of past lives. We actually don't believe in past lives. Past lives believe in us. But that stick of candy that you didn't get when you were 5 years old, and the tremendous problem that resulted in trying to get it, so you had a big problem trying to get it, and then you didn't get it, and so your brother was saying to you that you wouldn't have it, and you were saying that you would have it, and so forth. It's just never resolved one way or the other. It can still be found in your mind. You take a PC, will have stuck pictures in his mind to the direct ratio that he has problems. He has as many stuck pictures as he has problems. The stuck picture is just sort of a tag showing that a problem has existed in that area. That's all a stuck picture is. And the more problems a fellow has had, why, the more stuck pictures he's got. Well, fortunately, it isn't arithmetical, because it is monitored by the willingness to confront problems. So the willingness to confront problems is then expressed by whether or not he has ever confronted them. And that index to that is how many stuck pictures can you find in his bank. That's simple. I'm sure that you, or at least a PC of yours, or you, have sometime or another shut your eyes and seen a stuck picture. I'm sure that this has happened to you once in a while. And it wasn't about to go away. And you could chew at it. I'm not talking about auditing it now, because there'd be dozens of ways to handle it in auditing. But you chew at it, nibble around its edges, and sort of shake it up and admire it and do most anything that you could do to it, you see, and this picture is still stuck. It's interesting how long one of these pictures will stay stuck. One of the engineers that was helping me design the British Mark IV meter knew nothing about Scientology at all. He was aboard for electronics only, and I wanted to show him what the instrument was for. He sat down, he picked up the cans, he says, "Close your eyes." I said, "What are you looking at?" And he says, "Well, it's all black." And I said, "Well, what part of that blackness could you take responsibility for?" About a half an hour later, he had been in a space car and had had the sensation of traveling over the top of a hill with full kinetics, had watched a city blown up with atomic fission, and in general had had quite a lot of things happen. The date of it was totally unreal to him. It was something on the magnitude of 400 billion years ago. He knew nothing about it. He didn't ever imagine that he had ever had any connection with it in any way, shape, or form. And there it was, and it was able to produce all those kinetics with him. And he was very happy with it and very satisfied about it, and it changed his whole life, that half hour of auditing. I don't think he's ever been audited since. But he sure knows what a meter's for. Now, there is an example. There was some kind of a parked problem on the track. But, of course, you didn't see it in terms of a problem. You only saw it in terms of a picture. But isn't it interesting that the thing moved and changed when you ran responsibility on it? Now, let me show you that this person could resolve this problem by taking responsibility for the other point of view. And this person on this point of view could take responsibility for the person on this side. And if they mutually took responsibility for the thing, it of course would go zzz, and there would be no problem there. So, part of the anatomy of the problem is that vector A must take no responsibility whatsoever, ever, ever, for the viewpoint of vector B. And if they carefully arrange it so that A never takes any responsibility for B, and B never takes any responsibility for A, you will have a problem that will go on forever. You show me an organization. You show me an organization where everybody in it says that somebody else handles that. And I'll show you an organization that has a lot of problems. Inevitably, they have lots of problems. Because just by the one factor of responsibility, they are, of course, creating problems, because the anatomy of the problem means that vector A must not take responsibility for vector B, and vector B must not take responsibility for vector A, and thereupon and thereby, and only thereupon and thereby, will you get problems. One of the best ways to clean up problems in an organization or an activity is to go in and find out how willing people are to take responsibility for the things going on in the organization. Somebody walks in the front door. Is anybody willing to take responsibility to ask him, well, are you being taken care of? You find the person who is asking him, are you being taken care of, is in actuality a file clerk in office 18 and has nothing to do with reception. Now, that would be an organization that had few problems and was functioning very well. But the organization where you stand in the outer hall for a half an hour, and clerks and executives and so forth fly back and forth and by, because the receptionist isn't at her desk, I would go back of this facade and I could show you that the individuals in it were absolutely mired down with problems. They had problems beyond count. They had problems they didn't even know anything about. And every day they created another half a hundred. And the longer they run on the basis organizationally that A must take no responsibility for B's hat, and B must take no responsibility for A's hat, the more problems they will develop. Now you, of course, can take so much responsibility for B's hat that you take no responsibility for A's hat, and you get another series of problems. If vector A never does its job, and vector B never does its job, but B does all of A's job, and A does all of B's job, you now have new problems. Why? Because you've simply reversed these letters, and you have B, A. Elementary. A fair seasoning of good sense is very good with this, but it can be expressed practically mathematically. A must take responsibility for his vector and must be willing to take responsibility for B's vector, and B must take responsibility for his vector, and be willing to take responsibility for A's vector, and that problem will evaporate. But you've never been long at taking responsibility. Can you think of anybody right now that you wouldn't care to take responsibility for? You think of somebody? You think of somebody? Well, if you've thought of anybody, then I can tell you, you have a problem with that person. It's elementary as that, you see. Now, let's not look at it in reverse. This is straight way too. You haven't got a problem. You're unwilling to take responsibility for the person because you have a problem with him. You have a problem with a person because you're unwilling to take responsibility for him. It's the reversed. You can almost force a police officer to arrest you by doing this. Go down and stand against the corner of a building where you've stood before, not that you would attract any attention of the police, and watch the officer on that particular beat, and just stand there and postulate that you're taking absolutely no responsibility for the city government and no responsibility for that officer. And you could go on with this, just postulating this very forcefully, and he would practically turn around like an automaton and come over and arrest you for loitering. But to this degree, then, men make their own problems. That's for sure. They always make their own problems. But unable to handle these problems over a long period of time, we get a type of situation here where these simple problems each being timeless, wind up to, there was that first one at the top, right here at the bottom of this graph here, to, because remember, they're timeless. Now, let's multiply this. Of course, this would also be, the A's and B's would be on top of each other too, you see. Now, multiply this by 500. And I think you'd have a larger blob, wouldn't you? Remember, all these things are timeless. So they have no separate time to go any place else into except timelessness. A zone, an area of timelessness. So now let's multiply it by 500,000. I think that would make a somewhat bigger blob here on the bottom of this chart. And now let's multiply it on this reasonable assumption that you have had at least a problem every day of one side or another, which you resolved or not resolved, for the last 200 trillion years, thereby multiplied by 300 or 800 or 1,000 or 20 or however many days there were in a year on this planet or that planet. And this gives you a figure which is getting difficult to write on a long wall. And that is the goal's problem mass. You see what its exact anatomy is. Now, because the problem which the individual got today stacks up on this other mass, he is unable to as-is it easily and worries and fusses about it and is confused. And even when you audit it, it sometimes takes a half an hour or an hour to do something with this thing. There are some PCs that are terrified of getting a present time problem because it'll eat up the whole session every time they get one, and the auditor will always handle it if he's a good auditor. So if he's a good auditor, he ARC breaks the PC, you see, by handling the present time problem, because he has to handle a present time problem, because if he does, he finds himself auditing the whole goal's problem mass with a process that he wasn't intending to handle the problem's mass with. And of course, the PC cannot be audited on the whole goal's problem mass on a present time problem, and it is all very confusing. But that's because all of the problems of all of the ages of one's longevity are stacked up in the same timeless zone, and that is the reactive mind. So the reactive mind is that zone of timelessness in which is impressed all the accumulative and varied problems of a person's entire existence. Now, one of the things that's quite interesting about the reactive mind is that it can be parted at all. That you can get any part of it different from any other part of it. This is quite fascinating. How can you possibly do this? Well, just put it down to your skill and the fact that it hasn't totally condensed itself yet. And you'll find out that the reactive mind reacts instantly on everything, and that should be a sufficient proof. Reactive mind is an instant reaction. It reacts instantly. Why does it react instantly? Well, it reacts instantly because there is no time in it. So it will answer up as readily to a question about 200 trillion years ago as it will about a question yesterday. And it goes bang every time, providing you have a meter. Now, that is the anatomy of a bank. And that's what you've been in contest with. I'm sure that those of you who just arrived and are brought here by a friend in all innocence realize that this is something that other people have. But tonight, just as you're going to sleep, when you close your eyes, sort of open up one a little bit inside your head and see if there isn't a stuck picture mass out there someplace. And speculate for a moment what it might be, but don't speculate much longer. I find this a very fascinating fact, that the problem of the human mind could be as reasonably and as easily stated as you have heard in the last 40 minutes. So is this a very complicated thing if it could be described in 40 minutes? It isn't, is it? It's a little rough to take apart, and you have to know quite a bit to take it apart, but to understand what it is and how it operates on its most basic fundamentals is pretty good, because we got some bright young sprouts in here today. I'm always glad to see kids at a Congress. And I am very sure that some of these bright little young sprouts will explain this very carefully to their parents, who probably haven't gotten it too well. Because I'm sure their parents, here and there, will think, well, it must be much more complicated than that. Well, now you understand that I've simply expressed what it is. It begins with a search for longevity and ends up with all longevity now. Or all longevity is an absence of anything. It is inevitable longevity. They couldn't possibly keep from having longevity. And there's many a Thetan would love to lay aside his Thetan. Because life has become a wearisome burden. Every time he thinks thunk, he gets clunk. And he's so tired of it, you know. He sees this pretty girl. He sees this pretty girl. And he says to this pretty girl, and he can't say hello. So, of course, he wants to commit suicide on the whole track, you see? Think of the plight of the man. He couldn't possibly think of anything else. I stopped a man from committing suicide one time in the London Hazy. He walked into my office and he was very distraught. He was very upset. You see these people occasionally. Less of them than you would think in Scientology, but he was not a Scientology. Somebody had been sent in. And he'd been on the verge of blowing his brains out for a very long time. And he'd been processed for a while, and he was flying all to pieces in various directions, and the auditor had him patched together with sticky plaster, and then a piece of the plaster broke. And, you know, this modern plaster doesn't stick well at all. And he had been obsessively trying to commit suicide for many years, so he went straight back into this dramatization. He was busy trying to commit suicide. He came into my office, and he was in a screaming fit, and he was telling me and telling everybody in the organization that he was going to end it all. And I sat there calmly and looked at him, and I said, well, what's troubling you? And, oh, my God, you see, this almost drove him up to the roof that anybody could put it that mildly, you see? And, of course, I'm always willing to listen to people's troubles, perfectly all right, but I don't necessarily... I don't feel incumbent upon me to listen to them emotionally. Emotional listening is not necessary. You're listening, that's enough. And so I said, well, you don't quite understand what I meant. I mean, what actually goes or clunk or or askew and bothers you? You know, what is it? What is it? What's with it? Oh, he says, there's this horrible pressure, this pressure from down, this pressure, and he said, and I'm just going to blow my brains out and end it all. I said, well, that's just the point, son, it won't. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, who do you think is creating that pressure? Why, well, is it after you blow your brains out, I said, you're going to pull out of that body and take the pressure right along, and the next body you pick up, you'll have the pressure back again, and after all, you are here at Hazy. he says, and walks out and goes back into the auditing room and went back into session. There was no gag on my part. I had simply imparted the horrible fact to him. And he must have realized down deep someplace that the last 1,000 bodies he had knocked off because of that terrible pressure. And every time he knocked one off, it cured no terrible pressure because the terrible pressure was him. So these things are not a solution. So, of course, every time he solved the problem with suicide, which he had undoubtedly been doing for a very long time, every time he solved the problem with suicide, he, of course, simply added another failed problem to the mass of the reactive bank. So instead of making his condition bearable, he was making it less and less bearable. But there was no way out. No road out. No road of any kind. Man hates to look at this fact. But this bank is not something he got from his mother. This bank is something that he personally has been accumulating for a very long time as a totally dedicated activity. And it's something he's going to keep right on carrying with him and is not going to drop off by accident. It's something that's going to have to be audited out. And what auditing in Scientology is the first time anything, any place, anywhere, has been able to handle this thing called the bank. You could electric shock the fellow and it'd key it out. You could do this, you could do that, you could do other things and make him feel better for a moment. But every time you solved it, of course, you just added another problem on top of it. And it didn't look like it was getting very far. That perhaps would help you understand what Scientology is. It seems to me to have a better, instead of saying to somebody, well, if every day you touch your toe to the floor 5 times, you won't have ingrown hangnails. I don't think that's the order of magnitude with which we're operating. We're actually operating with the raw meat of human aberration. The raw meat of human beingness and the raw meat of human difficulty. And it's pretty raw. Now, what it takes to pull this apart and what it takes to handle this shouldn't be confused with what I have said about the simplicity of its expression, because that's quite complicated. It requires a level of precision that no auditor has previously ever attained. And we're just attaining it now, and we do handle that with that level of precision. But this is the difficulty. Explained, there it is. Now, actually, taking it apart is not difficult if it is done with great precision. But because this is human aberration, because this is difficulty, because this is the basic trap in which man finds himself, because this is the reactive mind, which Freud called the unconscious and all that other thing, because that is it, the taking apart of it has to be done neatly. You can't leave straws lying around and litter on the floor as you were doing this, because it just won't come apart. Remember, automobile accidents, train accidents, spaceship accidents, falling into suns, being born on Earth. The most cataclysmic activities have assaulted this being and haven't shaken this up, but merely added to it. And every one of those cataclysms is contained in it, in folded up, crisscrossed over which pictures, or from pictures floating free and loose out here. And when you take it apart, you have to be neat. You have to be precise and deft and neat. Otherwise, the PC starts reacting much worse than he ordinarily would, naturally. Because it's overwhelmed him all this time, it is very easy to overwhelm him with it some more. Now, what these things add up to and what these things are composed of and that sort of thing, the identities and so on, require a considerable precision of detection and neatness and so on. My victory is not so much being able to express this thing, although that is a considerable victory. It's more on the technical side of affairs. The victory is that I've been able to get auditors to do it. They have been able to do this, and that has not been entirely true of all the techniques of yesteryear. I'll give you an idea of what I mean. Do you remember step six? Do you know that step six would work this very day? But did any auditor really look at step six? It says, with a meter, find a null object. Thereby, with a bad E-meter, with bad E-metering, and with the rudiments out, it could have never gone anyplace because they never would have had a null object. Auditors could not do that one. People got into trouble with that one. And it resulted in no clears, no matter how well-intentioned the auditors were about it. Well, today these other technologies are far more complex than this, merely testing on a meter for a null object. They're far more complex, but auditors are able to do them with great success and great ease, providing they are considerably trained. They have to be very, very, very arduously and precisely trained in order to accomplish them easily. Don't disabuse yourself of that. I'm not trying to sell training with the organizations or trying to sell you a British Mark IV meter. The precision it requires in terms of training can be acquired. The instrument exists by which it can be done. Auditors are doing it successfully. There's no difficulties along in those lines. We're making good and ample progress. And we even have something a fellow can do before he gets up to what you call a 3D assessment or requires a Class 3 auditor. That is very easy to do. People needn't start feeling so queasy about getting... Don't get audited now because there aren't any Class 3 auditors around or something like that. That's all nonsense. Go and get audited now because you have to get your primary and fundamental steps out of the road before anybody who could do Class 3 activities would even look at you. You see? So there's the way that is. We have these tools. We have the anatomy of this thing. We know where it's going. We know what we can do with it. We know we can straighten these things out. We've got it there. It simply requires a considerable sincerity, and it requires a considerable application, and it requires an absolute zero of missed withholds on people. It requires a reality and a realization that Scientology works, and so therefore it is well worth making work well. That is the other part of the phrase. And basically, under those fundamentals, here's the anatomy of the bank. Precise tools exist to take it apart. The skills can be taught. Auditors can do these things. There are many lighter things can be done which assist this operation and have to be done before you can start in with a knife and sledgehammer. And there it is. It's pretty well a fait accompli. It's incumbent upon us now, it's incumbent upon us broadly to put a shoulder to the wheel, demand that level of precision and preciseness, demand that level of skill and training, demand the precision necessary in an E-meter, and get sincere and get very alert to these various factors, and as a group mores, bring them into being and make them stick, and we will have won the whole way. There is no doubt about that in my mind. And I can tell you with great confidence, in the next few months, you will have, certainly at the latest, no slightest doubt about it in yours. Thank you.